It is time for Monday Mayhem, and it might be a day off, but I have a big lineup. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 stories. So we're going to be hauling butt through this stuff today to get it all done. I want to keep this under an hour. That's my commitment with Monday Mayhems. And for those that are new here, Monday Mayhem goes back like 18 years, not the name, but the concept. When I started the show, I was in my car driving down the road, trying to avoid accidents about 45 minutes every day. And the only time I had to actually do a podcast was during my commute to my office. So I did it for 18 months that way. It's not the same, but it's similar pattern recognition. If you've been around long, you know what I'm talking about. All right. So we're going to go straight into it with our lead story today. I've been talking about the college enrollment cliff for a very, very long time. And everything I bring up today on the screen or I mentioned there's a link for is in the audio notes. If you're watching the video, right down there in the video notes, there's a bunch of yummy links. But the first one will go over to my site, thesurvivalpodcast.com, and go to today's episode when the live stream's over, not while it's going on. And you can source all this stuff for yourself. I don't put things out without sources. Anyway, this was sent to me by a listener, and it is on Wall Street Journal, so I had to use Archive Today to break through the paywall to actually get the full article and see if it was what it matched up to. And it is. Here's the headline. Hundreds of colleges are sending acceptance letters to kids who didn't even apply. This is really interesting to me. And they have a term for it. Like they do with anything that they come up with, it's nonsense. That they want to make it sound like it's been a thing forever, even though it hasn't. They call it direct admissions. What this basically means is these colleges scour student records. And they say, all of these people would qualify under our admittance, and they do them. And then they like kind of, they do, I'm sure they have a marketing company who does some like database cleanup, like who's most likely to say yes based on where they live and things like that. And then they just do like a mass mailing. Congratulations. You've been, accepted to Asplund University. And a lot of these are private colleges for now, but we're starting to see like your middle tier public education institutions doing this as well. The desperation at this point that the colleges have to maintain the control that they've had for 35, 40 years is palpable. And this was very evident for those that have been around a while. You know, if you go all the way back almost to the very beginning when I was talking about being in the car, I was talking about this being a thing all the way back then. And over the years, I've said it's getting more and more critical. And I said probably 5 years ago that it would be about 2025 to 2027 that you would see it go into supercritical mode. You would see things like colleges closing down parts of their campuses. You would see some colleges, smaller private institutions, just disappear. Princeton and Harvard and Stanford and all weren't going anywhere anytime soon. But even they might start downsizing some of their programs, doing more online, things like that. And it's all happened. Now we're at a point where, geez, if we don't get more students in the door, we're going to have to like do all the things Jack said. I'm sure they don't have the meeting that way. They don't care about me or know who I am, but it's still the case. Like the things I'm talking about, this is what they're dealing with now. And so some genius somewhere, probably not even in the college system. Okay. This is probably the marketing sector is out there looking for clients too. And they see when you're in the marketing world, which is what I used to do, what you look for is people that have a problem reaching their target market, and then you develop messaging for that, and you take that to the company, or in this case, the institution, trying to reach that market and say, we can get you more people. Because I just don't think the people that run universities are smart enough about marketing to do this shit on their own. But that's what they're doing. They're doing create a database, data rake the database, and do a targeted mailing. So if you think about, like, if you watched movies that were made 20 years ago and back, you would see like, you know, think of Rudy, right? Remember Rudy? My kid's going to Notre Dame, right? At the steel mill, right? Like the kid gets I got accepted too. And then, woo, you got accepted. And you had to apply. Now, when I was in school in the 80s in rural Pennsylvania, if you weren't going to go to like a Penn State or Pittsburgh or something like that, or a private larger school or something like a Temple or a Notre Dame or something, some big school, like you just didn't have the grades, the clout, or the money for that, then you turn to like the mid-tier public institutions in the state. These were universities like Kutztown University, Bloomberg University, named after a town in Pennsylvania, not the billionaire from New York. And you couldn't just get in. Like, you had to have good SAT scores, decent class rank, and be like a solid B student. Like, if you had a C here or there, sure, okay. But if you weren't like sitting at like a 3.4 GPA and ticked the boxes on all the courses, like 2 years of foreign language, certain levels of math, et cetera, based on the path you wanted to take, you were getting in. And, you know, it wasn't like anybody was like fist bumping, I got into Kutztown, right? Like, woo! I guess a few were. But there were people that tried to get in and couldn't that were not stupid. There was some competition for it, and then those were the people that had to, like, defer off to, like, community college. Or, like, there was a place up there called McCann School of Business, which was a nonsensical certificate mill, wasn't even a diploma mill, and they would go off and do things like that, or they'd go off and do something like, you know, go become a medical assistant or something and end up working in an old folks home wiping asses or something. That was, like, your different career paths that went out of there. You had to be a certain level to actually get into a university. Those universities today will literally take anybody. I mean, they have an admissions process, but if you have a pulse and qualify for student loans, they're going to take you. This whole thing is coming unraveled. And I would say it's about time, except you don't know what the fallout looks like. I wrote an article about this all the way back during COVID. You're going to start seeing in some places towns literally dissolve, because there are towns all over this country where small universities, small private institutions are the town. They're bringing 14,000, 15,000, 18,000 people into that school every year. And as they graduate out, they bring another, you know, into the bottom. So they keep that total student body count somewhere between 10 and 20,000. When you have a town with a permanent population of, let's say, 30,000 people in it, that pulsing in and out of those students is a huge part of their economics, their GDP for their city, whatever you call that, right? And then you think about all the people that work in that college, right? They all live there too. You don't work, some small university in Nebraska or something and live in Florida. That's not a thing. You live where you teach. That's how the university system still works. And so you have very well-paid people in these positions, these professors and whatnot. These are not low-paid individuals, even though they try to pretend that they're poor. And they have really nice homes. And as this starts to fall apart and these institutions close and downsize, you're going to start seeing these towns collapse the way a lot of towns collapsed in the 60s, 70s, and 80s as we began to outsource work elsewhere. In other words, the business is still there. Educating people is still a business. Getting them ready for careers is still a business. We still have a large population of people that need it, but they're taking alternatives. That's what's really going on. Distance-based education, going to community college and not seeing it as a downside, or taking specific training that is designed to teach them a skill set that's actually marketable and not really worrying about a degree. More and more and more of this is happening. And then on top of it all, the population's in decline. The total population is in decline, and it's in decline because people are having less kids. And we are now hitting a point where if you're 20 years old, right, then you were born in 2006, right? That's not like you don't have to be a genius to figure that out. But think about the parents of people that were born in 2006 and how less children they were having than the parents that had kids that were born, let's say, in 1986. And now think about the attitude that a person that's 25 to 30 years old has right now about having kids as an aggregate average. And you have one place for this to go, and it's downhill. And that's why they're trying to import the third world. They don't care if these people are qualified. They just want bodies in seats to take out loans, to educate themselves, to bullshit. Anyway, let's move on from there. Real quick, let's hit our sponsors of the day up today. Sponsor of the day number one today is JM Bullion. I really believe that everybody should have some hard assets in their life. I am a huge fan of Bitcoin. You guys know that, but I'm also a huge fan of silver and gold. JM Bullion has some of the best pricing in the industry. Certainly better pricing, a little bit here and there, better than like Lear Capital and other companies like that you see advertised on AppMex, et cetera. You see advertised on like the major channels and stuff like that. I also know the president of the company personally. I can send out an email to him if there's ever a problem. There's almost never a problem, but I can do it. They give you a discount, all orders ship free, and it's the same silver and gold you get anywhere else. So I wouldn't go anywhere but here. These are the people that sponsor the show that you love. I mean, the one exception I make, if you buy from a local shop, I get that. But if you're going to be buying online, buy your silver and gold from JM Bullion. Remember, I recommend about 5% of your net wealth in silver and or gold or other precious metals like platinum. Check them out today, and you'll see why they have been a long-term sponsor. These guys joined us in 2013. It's 2026. So they've been with us 13 years. They're loyal to us, so you guys be loyal to them. Next up, let's talk about Biltong and Biltong USA, Anton Van Buren's company. Biltong done properly because good meat deserves better. That's what you'll get at Biltong USA. You also can check out their dry sausages like the Drew Wars, the Kalabanazi. Those are kind of my favorites along with the sticks. And you'll see those marketed sticks, STIX. That's basically crispier Biltong. Like it's all the trimmings off the sides of the eyes of round and other cuts that Anton uses. And they're kind of somewhere between Biltong and jerky. I like to cut them up with a pair of shears, so little small bites, and it's kind of like meat peanuts. I really love them. Check them out, and you'll see why. Also, Anton does do a discount for MSB members as well. All right, moving on. Let's go ahead and talk about something I found really interesting. So I followed this dude that calls himself Dad Bod Veteran, and I've followed him for a long time. This guy is, I would say, a little bit younger Gen X than I am, but he's definitely solidly Gen X, and he's been making content for quite a long time in the short form video world. He's a really funny dude. He does this like weird, almost English accent thing. And he started out with all this shtick about, you know, like, yes, sir, they're going to take away your man card for that and all. But he ended up hooking up with a whole group of other short form producers, content creators, Sherry, the real Slim Sherry, right? And the professors, black dude, really cool guy. That are all in this Gen X world and talking a lot about Gen X. And that's kind of when he really started to blow up, when all these guys kind of put their, like, you know, influencer power together. And he just dropped this video not so long ago. He's now started doing some more like podcast length format, you know, 20, 25 minute stuff. And he just put out this piece, and the title of it is Gen X is Retiring Early, How He Said, You Know What? I'm good. But when you listen to it, because I like the guy. I wasn't fully on board with the premise, but you always have to realize titles are to get you to watch. And once you watch, then sometimes things change. His real upshot is not so much that Gen X is like, the way he put it, like, we're not saying that every Gen Xer listened to a Whitesnake song and rage quit his job and went off to retire. What he's saying is that Gen X is largely still in the workplace, not really the workplace, but in the workforce. We just tend not to work for anybody anymore. We have determined that you're better off having a business or being a consultant or being a contractor and not sitting behind a desk in an office in a cubicle every day. And it's not even the majority of Gen X that have done this. It's just the number of people in Generation X is a relatively small cohort compared to boomers and millennials in total body count. Our percentage of people doing that is way higher than anybody else. And the concept is we were the figure shit out generation. We were the generation everybody called Generation Slacker, but we worked harder than everybody else. And we really did. We were the ones you threw a project at with no clear instructions and you got something. Maybe you didn't get exactly what you wanted. That's your fault, but we got it done. And over time, we have started to realize kind of like we're stuck in this like middle role. We got these old people that refuse to leave to make room at the top. And you got these people at the bottom that don't know what they're doing. And it's the Gen X people sitting in the middle that know how everything works. They know what vendor can never be trusted. They know what vendor shipments are always late. They know how to fix the one machine in the back, right? They know the sound that the thing makes right before it explodes. They're the people that know all the things. And they do all the things. And they get all the things dropped on them. And they're constantly doing all the extra work. And eventually they realize, like, you know, I don't have to do this. I don't have to do this. And I think actually that's accelerating now. I think it's the case that you're going to have a higher – I'm not going to say body count, because again, the cohort's still working, then you will Gen X in another 3 to 4 years. And here's the question in this. What happens to corporate America in that situation? I mean, they're all about laying people off and shit, but these are the people, this is the E4 mafia, if you're familiar with that term, right? If you're a military person, the E4 mafia is like your specialist, like corporals technically, yes, but in the Army anyway, it's your specialists, right? They're like junior NCOs. They don't have all the responsibility of an NCO, and they don't have the ability to just be effed with the way a private or a private first class does. They have a certain amount of autonomy and a responsibility, and there's a lot of them. And sergeants all outrank them. But when they need shit done, that's where they go. Now, that's unique in the military. You know, your average specialist is probably 22 years old or 21 years old or, you know, 23 years old, somewhere in that range, at least when they first get promoted. So it's not proportional to Gen X in society, but it's the same thing. It's the same pattern. It's the shit you need done that they know how to do that you don't. And what a lot of them are figuring out is, I can go be a consultant. And I can get a contract with the company I work for right now. They can pay me twice as much to do the same thing. Because when I'm not here to do it, they figure out they really don't know how to do it. Yeah. And so I think it's just really interesting. But the first thing that came to my mind when I was listening to him talk was E4 Mafia. E4 Mafia, man. Like, if you piss off the E4, you can be a freaking SAR first class, an E7, and you piss off the E4 Mafia. You won't see it directly, but somehow all the shit you need won't happen, or it won't happen easily. And you can yell, and you can knife hand at people, and you can demand, and you can do whatever you want. But until you make peace with the E4 Mafia, the E4 Mafia gonna mafia, right? This was the case when I was a soldier. This is all the way back in the early 90s. We didn't even call it that yet. I don't even know when that term came. I think that term's only about 10-ish years old, honestly, right? And for me, we're looking back 35, 40 years almost, right? So I don't know where and when that term started, but the first time I heard it, it required no explanation. I knew exactly what it was. And if you had an E4 mafia in corporate America, it's Gen X, just something to think about. Moving on, recently, the Netherlands had to move some gold. Well, they didn't have to, but they chose to move some gold. How much gold, you ask? Well, I'm glad you asked. $12 billion worth of gold. So there's two angles of the story I want you to think about. Number one is, why would the Netherlands do this? So they had 59 tons of gold in New York, which is where a lot of countries keep their gold reserves in the United States. It's considered the safest place to do so. The U.S. can be trusted. So what they ended up doing was they sold 59 tons in New York and purchased it back in London. They didn't actually put it on a plane and ship it the way that the image infers. But it still took them 6 months to do. And you might wonder why. Well, $12 billion is a lot of money. And when you say you're selling it to who? It's not like going out and selling GLD as a ETF on the market. It has to go to somebody who has to take delivery of who wants it. So you have to get somebody to take it. Then you have to run the float and hope you don't lose your ass on it. And then buy it back from somebody willing to sell that much gold on the other side of the Atlantic. Why did they take this approach? Because physically moving it the way you see in this picture would be cost prohibitive. It would cost probably 10% the value of the gold. That's $1.2 billion. That's some real change. So it wasn't really feasible to physically move the gold. But why would you go through all this shit? Here's your gold. It's in New York. It's with an ally. The United States is an ally. Why? They're part of the freaking NATO. Like, why would you do this? Because the economy's going to shit, folks. This is just another example of the economy going to shit. In fact, going completely to shit. When you start seeing countries willing to go through all this crap to repatriate their gold, that means they're losing confidence And our currency is the global reserve currency. Because when that bubble pops, and so we just did a show on it 2 weeks ago, right? When that bubble pops, and it has to sooner or later, it is not like, oh, the U.S. is screwed now. It's, oh, we're all screwed until we figure out how to cobble things back together. The reason they haven't cut the strings from us yet is we have, you know, we're still in a world of like mutually assured destruction. Like if all of our creditors, our international creditors say, we're dumping the bonds, they're not going to get anything for them. There's nobody to buy them now. And then you shit can the dollar. Okay, great. And now you shit can your currency that's tied to it. So the whole world goes into a shit can of currencies all at once. So you have to have some high level of reserve asset for the rebuilding. And what the Netherlands just clearly said is, we do not trust the United States with our gold if that happens. We want our gold back here. Now, you can move it from London to the Netherlands a hell of a lot easier. And, of course, you got the EU there. England's technically not part of it anymore, but they're a lot closer ties than we are and a lot more closely politically aligned than we are. And getting your gold across the English Channel, not that hard. So I don't know that they're going to fully repatriate it, but they sure moved it. Like, it would be like moving your gold, let's say, from Japan. Nah, it's not that far. Let's say it'd be like moving your gold from England to Georgia, the United States state Georgia, and your country's Florida. Kind of like that, right? There is water in between, though, but that's how close you are. You're very, very close at that point. So they don't trust us with their gold, and they don't trust us to not collapse. That's what that says. Now, what's the other angle on this? Did you see who posted it, documenting Bitcoin? If the Netherlands had been holding 12, or any entity had been holding $12 billion worth of Bitcoin, you don't even have to technically move it. You control it from anywhere in the world. It actually exists on a chain. But if you did need to transfer it, like I need this to go from entity A to entity B, even if I own both of them, it's super fast and cheap, 10 minutes and it's done, super secure. So this is why gold loses to Bitcoin right there in one image, being able to move 12 billion in sovereign assets from one side of an ocean to another. You can do it at the speed of light and you can do it with incredible security, or you can go through all the bullshit they had to, or you can load up tankers with it, hope they don't sink, hope they don't get pirated, hope they don't get shot, and physically move the bars. Yes, if you're moving $100 or even $1,000, even $5,000 worth of gold, physically moving it's pretty easy. You still have much more risk than moving digits across cyberspace. But this is just, it's what I said. Almost every story has a Bitcoin angle, even if you don't stretch. I don't have to stretch for that. That was served up on a silver platter. Let's go to something totally different. This is a meme. I'm going to describe it for those of you who can't see it because you're on the audio only. But it says, train how you fight. And the top part of the image says what they think it means. And it's like a kitted up AR, a tactical shirt, a helmet, and a tactical vest. And then the bottom, it says what it really means. A bathrobe, a Glock, and a glass of whiskey on the rocks, X6. In other words, six whiskeys. Now, this was clearly done for humor, which is why I ripped it off and reposted it, because I knew that it would get a reaction, because it is kind of funny, right? You know, you got your whiskey and your bathrobe and some shit goes on at your door, and that's the situation you're in. However, the reason it's funny is because there's a lot of truth in it. Let's say you're, you know, six. That's quite a few freaking old fashions or highballs, guys. Man, you want to dial it back. But let's say you're a dude that, you know, most nights you have a drink or two to end your day with. Many of us do. And let's say that it's a Friday, so you're like, well, I'm going to get up tomorrow. It's been a rough week. Maybe I'm going to have four or five or six. When are you more likely to need to use a gun for defense? When you go to your tactical training class and somebody's dumb enough to try to rob it, so you got all your gear and shit, or Red Dawn really happens, right? Or you're somewhere and you've got all your gear stored in your truck and there's a big to do going on and you run in and help law enforcement and they don't shoot you, or your own freaking house. Maybe not in a robe. Not everybody wears a bathrobe. Like I said, I'm going to be naked, but okay, same shit, right? Or, you know, you're in your boxers, in a t-shirt or whatever. This is actually way more to the point true than it is humor. Now, it was taken to the extreme, as most good humor is. However, what is training how you fight? Training how you fight, honestly, is going to be for most engaged situations where somebody has to use a concealed handgun or a firearm of any type, is going to come one of three ways. One is you're at a place where there's like a public shooting, a restaurant, a place where like a concert, like we've seen these things happen, right? These mass shootings. And you happen to be there, so you become the first responder, right? And that means you're carrying probably either appendix or small back or what, you know, 10 o'clock or whatever you carry. And you're in street clothes. And that's it. And you are listening to music 1 minute and hearing pop, pop, pop the next. That's reality. The other is you are individually targeted in a parking lot, in an alley somewhere. Somebody decides they want to harass you, jack you up if you're a woman, maybe try to sexually assault you, whatever. And you're isolated somewhere and you have kind of that same millisecond to act. Hopefully in those two places, you're not drunk off your ass. You haven't had whiskey times six. And please, for the love of God, I know people drink at concerts and stuff, but you're somewhere where you can carry. You don't need to be drinking while you're carrying, right? Especially out in public. This is a recipe to go to prison. Maybe one, but not drinking, right? However, you're in your own home. This is your third place that you're most likely to have to use your weapon. And they're not in order here. This is they're kind of all equal, really, in reality. Somebody tries to break in your house. This is happening more and more. People are just targeting the location and saying, that looks like a good place to break in. They knock, they feign that they need some help or whatever. And as soon as that door opens, they're going in with a gun in your face. This meme's way more accurate than I think it was intended to be. And I think that's why it's an effective meme. And I think we maybe need to have an episode in the future about training how we fight. Because if you're all kitted up, unless you're a soldier or on a SWAT team or something, you are not training how you're going to fight. That's just reality, whether people want to admit it or not. All right, next up, let's talk about TSP 26. I want to remind you guys again, tickets are going to go on sale Saturday morning, the 19th, at 9 o'clock a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm going to say that again to be abundantly clear. Saturday, September 19th, this is the important part, 9 a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm in Pacific. Do the conversion. We don't care where you are. We don't have any control over your time zone. I have this happen a lot of times. People are like, oh, I got the time zone wrong. Sorry. Like, I can't be more clear. And so you need to be in the Telegram channel or group to have the best shot of getting into the workshop this year. Because that's what I do is that morning at 9 a.m. exactly, I control V into all the Telegram stuff. So if you're an alum and you're in the alumni group, which is cool, but you have to be a former student, have been here before, or the channel or the group, any of those things, right at 9, it just pops up like magic. You click it, you sign up. We only are selling 50 tickets. We usually have those tickets. Yeah, Roanoke TSP is correct. Fast. Our record was 1 minute and 30 seconds. That was during the height of COVID and karaoke is awesome, right? But it's usually somewhere around about 10 to 15 minutes. Sometimes we have two or three seats available for like out to a half hour. You just don't know. The point is, in most instances, if you'll show up at 9 a.m., you will get in. I have people all the time. I can't get in. Did you get there at 9? No, I showed up at 10:30. I don't know what to tell you. Like, I think sometimes people think I'm just doing this to market. It is not marketing. It is a sincere, honest plea for those who want to come to please take the deadline seriously because it happens. Anyway, what I want to actually talk about today is we're starting to figure out some of the meals and stuff that we're going to have. And I am doing a Jamaican jerk sausage for you guys this year. It'll be smoked. It's going to be really, really great. I put out a video about it yesterday. But I hit play on this, and hopefully there won't be any sound coming across. If there is, tell me. There's a new feature in StreamYard where you can make sure that the other frames are muted out. But I do my sausage differently than a lot of people do. I learned to make sausage from a Dutch farmer named Schnoke when I was like 15 years old. And this is what he taught me to do, is to come up with all your ingredients that are going to go, all the seasonings, herbs and stuff that are going to go in there, and dice your meat and then mix that in and leave it overnight before you grind it. And then grind it with it, and it will make all the mixing easier and go faster for you. So last workshop that I did a Jamaican jerk sausage, I did chicken to prove it could be done and be good, and it was. It was a lot of work. The pork is easier, so if you're not a pork eater, I'm sorry, but this is going to be freaking fantastic, and it is not the only extra special thing that we're going to be doing this year. We're going to have, you know, it's a typical thing where we have different speakers teaching different subjects. Nick Fergus is going to be talking about, you know, basically a form of IMO for your gardening and soil health and stuff like that. Joe Riles is going to be talking about security. Sean Mills is going to be talking about AI as a force multiplier for the everyday person. We're going to have panels and all that, but we're going to have probably an hour and a half on the patio like we did for the 10-year, if you were here for the 10-year. But it's going to be just, you know, an hour and a half, and it's going to be Friday because that's when we have food catered. So we're not in the cook's way doing this. And we're going to have kind of a porch time where we're going to put out some really cool special things. Now, not that sausage, because that sausage is going on the big menu for Saturday night where we have the meat to palooza festivals and stuff. But like, I have a new way of making something called a potato fondant. And it's really cool, and anybody can do it. And it's like so chefy, high-end Michelin restaurant looking. And I have a way not only to make it super easy, because it's always been easy, it's just time-consuming, to make it, set it and forget it, and throw 20 of them in your freezer and be able to pull them out and make them anytime you want. And it's something, it's a potato. And it's a potato. Oh, wait, it's amazing. We have some other cool stuff that we're going to be doing out on the patio with some cooking hacks. And this is going to be small bites. So like if there's a chicken wing thing I'm going to do, you're going to get a wing. The potato thing, you're going to get a potato, right? Like that. We'll have drinks. We'll discuss it. And people can, you know, kind of just stand off to the side, not really pay attention if they don't care about how, and just get their samples as they come out. Chef Ken will be helping with it. But it's going to be a blast. And if you were here for the 10-year, we did like a whole day on the porch. And it was just a celebration instead of learning. It'll be like that, condensed down. Probably be some really cool drinks poured and some other stuff. Now, here's another thing that's probably – I got to talk to Ken today when I get done with this. Ken was talking about bringing either a whole lamb or goat to break down and teach you how to do it as a workshop, which we will do if everything works out. But he's like, we could cook it. I'm like, well, how are we going to cook it? Well, Nicole Sauce has what's called a cajachina, which is a big, giant roaster box. And I talked to her and said, is there anybody coming here? Because I'll give them a guaranteed pass. Like, I won't give it to them for free, but I will give them like $100 for gas, extra gas money, and I'll give them a guaranteed seat. She says, well, I'm driving down. So it looks like she could bring her cajachina down, and we could do a whole roasted lamb. And I'm going to talk to Ken about maybe some other things that go with that to bring that up. So what I'm just saying here is if you've been thinking about coming to one of these, and you're like, I'll get to it someday. Someday needs to be soon. You don't always get another someday. You don't know that someday, you know, Jack might change his mind and not do these anymore. Not that I have any plans to do it, but you just don't know. And there's always something that changes in your life. I will make you a promise. If you come to one of these workshops, it will not be the last one you come to unless there's a reason for that. In other words, unless for some reason you can't anymore, what I was just kind of hitting on. Because once you do, you'll understand what I'm talking about. And I know when somebody says, you have to experience it to understand it. Again, it sounds like marketing. My people that have been here, that have come, tell them that I'm being honest. I did not create this the way that it ended. This was a group creation. Like the very first ones were like, we're going to put in like a food forest or whatever. That's all that it was. And what I did to make that better than everybody else was I went to like 20 events and went, here's all the shit I didn't like about the way they did things. I'm not going to do that. But then you guys transformed it. Nicole and freaking David changed the whole thing. Hawkeye Harry changed the whole interaction. And a lot of what we do is a group community project. The only other place you're going to get anything close to it is at Nicole Sauces. And there's a reason for that, okay? And Nicole's, you're going to get almost the same experience. The geography changes. We have developed something as a community that is amazing. $600, 3.5 days, amazing food, amazing meals, amazing drink, amazing conversation, amazing people. Saturday, the 19th, 9 a.m. Central. Be there or be left out and wish you were here with us, all the cool people. All right, now let's go on. I thought we'd have something fun today, okay? Just something completely for fun, but we're going to hold out on that. I wanted to let you know another thing, too. I talked about doing an AI course on how to find a business for you to start. Not a list of businesses, not, hey, give me 10 great businesses to start in 2026. Like, to actually analyze yourself first as a potential founder. What can you do? What do you know? What are the opportunities? How does it align? Then that begins to form the concept of what businesses make sense for you. And then the most powerful thing that AI can do, red team. Red team means attack. If you're a software developer, when you think your software is ready to deploy, you hire top-end hackers and say, break it. And if they break it, you fix it and say, break it again. And you keep fixing it until they can't break it anymore. That's red teaming. We need red teaming in our lives. I built red teaming into this new course. It is a 15-day course. It is self-led. You run. You can buy it anytime you want once we release it. It is not like it sells out and you don't get it. So it's, you can just take it. You can work faster than the pacing we put into it. We will release the modules 1 week at a time once you sign up. There's a login at jackslaws.com. You tick it off as you go, right? You can take notes. You can ask for customer support. It's a full-on course that guides you through using AI to find this business, okay? When you get to the third week, that's when you actually red team yourself first and the businesses second, and at the end of this, you end up with two businesses. Your primary, the one you think you're going to do, and a backup in case you decide that's not what you want. But for your primary business, on the last day of the course, you have a 60-day launch plan. Everything you need to do to get that business up off the ground. I came up with the idea for this course around the 28th or 29th of August. It is done. Tom is putting the last polishes on the back end. I have a couple videos to do for your get ready to get ready period. Here's how we're going to handle the pacing. If you sign up on a Tuesday, you start the next Monday. You sign up on a Friday, you start the next Monday. You sign up on a Saturday, you start the next Monday. You got it? And it would actually be good to sign up, you know, early in the week. Because you have time to do the part that's called get ready to get ready. That's part of what I need to do the videos on. This is coming up with all the stuff you know how to do. The stuff you would put on a resume and the stuff you wouldn't. And a bunch of other things. Monday it starts and you'd work through week one. And then you have the weekend to think. And then you work through week two. And then you have the weekend to think. And then you work through week three. And you're sitting there with a 60-day launch plan in your hand. We've built that. It is ready to go. We're going to sell for $99. I think it is a hell of a deal. In my head, it was a $50 to $60 course until I built it and went through building it. And Tom went, are you crazy? What's wrong with you, basically? Like, why? Like, he didn't even tell me I was wrong about the price. He just said it himself and said, yeah, that's it. It's worth that much, right? I'm like, okay. But we came up with a plan. We want to make these new, quicker to take courses get off the ground. So we're launching it Monday. 9 a.m. That seems to be a good time to launch things. Monday, 9 a.m. Central. So this is next Monday, which I don't know what day that is, but it's 1 week from today. And again, it's not a race because if you want to take it a month from now, you just can. It's a one-off course. However, for the first 200 people, there's an incentive. The first 100 people will get this course, which is going to be a $100 or $99 course. It's the 14th. You're correct. So on the 14th, we'll drop it. The first 100 people that sign up, you get it for $69. From 101 to 200, $79. And after that, it goes to $99 for everybody. And we are already halfway through. The next course is going to be a little bit more complicated, but halfway through developing it. And for people that take this course, it will be, now take that business plan and implement it. guided through that implementation process. So we are moving very quickly here. And what I'm trying to do, because of like all the bad economic shit I have to deliver. Yes, I built that course. We've been very successful with it on how to maximize and optimize your business, build SOPs, and build marketing to customers. Okay. You have to have a business for that course to help you. What we're trying to do now is build an on-ramp for the people that don't. And may I make a suggestion, even if they don't come up with a business, if you are a homeschool family with teenagers, this might be one of the best electives you could ever create for them. And the beauty of this course is when it's over, you have the guidebook, you can run this process, reiterate it as many times as you want. So keep an eye out for that. We'll probably have an opt-in list this week for announcements and whatever, but it's that simple. It's going to be available at 9 a.m. and I will put it out Telegram, just like I do with the workshop, Telegram, social media, all that stuff. And I'll email the night before the whole email list that's going to be available in the morning. So first 200 get a bit of a discount. It's not huge, but it's something, right? So it's $69, $79, then $99 after that. All right, moving on. Let's talk about just something for fun. So I was watching this video, and it was a whole bunch of, like, creative insults. Like, you know, the kind of insult that makes a person have – some of them anyway – kind of have to think about it before you realize, hey, I was just insulted, and I was insulted fairly well. So I did this post. I also did it on X. X had a little bit more X content, right? Like X-rated content. There's a few of those here that I will not read. I'm not going to read the whole list, but I'm going to read through basically community. I'm going to call this community sourced insults. So these are all from followers that I have on Facebook. And the post I made was, let's hear some creative insults. I will start. And mine was, I bet the place you work at got a tax break for hiring you. And I said, go. And let's see what we came up with. Russell said, I envy people that haven't met you. This one's too long. Brian says, did your mom do a lot of heroin before you were born? I've had smarter bowel movements. You just stink. That's from David Allen. You, sir, are a loathsome toad. Not too funny, but it is kind of direct. Brad says, if knowing is half the battle, you should definitely sit this one out. I would ask you to answer, but I already know what AI will say. Wow, you really are that educated. Martin Snow, I love this one. You are a testament to the wonders of modern society. The fact that even you can survive to your age and participate in any way is nothing short of miraculous. Sean Mills said, I know you tried your best. That's what makes it so disappointing. That fits with a meme I just sent to my buddy that's still a first sergeant in the Army. He said he's going to get this into a PowerPoint at some point because he's Figmo now at the end of his career and waiting for his retirement date. But it said, you did your best, and it's fucking embarrassing. Kind of the same place. Matt Sersley, right from Expert Counsel. My days of not taking you seriously have certainly come to a middle. Oh, God. You're the human equivalent of a participation trophy. You bring everyone so much joy when you leave. Those are both from Nicholas. I know you're doing your best, but try someone else's best. From Morris. I say this about my dog all the time. He's got two brain cells, and they're both fighting over third place. Nick Covey, having you here is like sending two good workers home. I like that one. Paul says they hide information from people like you in books. You've achieved the remarkable feat of being overeducated and undercapable at the same time, from Brad. Adam said you're as useful as tits on a boar hog. Oldie but goodie there. Jeff said, you're not much of a thinking person, are you? Dustin, I would assume that when you look in the mirror, you see a face looking back at you devoid of thought and reason. Ashton says, that boy's cornbread isn't done in the middle. John, you're like a dog who thinks he's clever for pooping behind the couch. Lee said, I'm not firing you. I'm freeing you to pursue excellence elsewhere. Your mother's so fat, she outweighs the needs of the many with a Spock hand. You're the human version of a participation trophy. There must be a no, I'm not reading that one. I could explain it to you, but I love my crayons at home. You have a rare talent of speaking at length without disturbing the facts. Were you born that stupid, or did you have to work at it? It's truly remarkable that you were the strongest swimmer your father had. If you're moving any slower, you'd be going backwards. Would you say being an ass is something you worked for, or is it a natural talent? At least I didn't take the short bus to school. You think you're hot shit on a silver platter, but you're a cold turd on a paper plate from his grandmother, from Penny's grandmother, her grandmother. Has anyone told you that you're doing a good job? No? You might want to sit with that one for a minute. No, I'm not reading that one. I bet you couldn't play in the sandbox when you were a kid because a cat kept trying to bury you. God. John Dowie says, my favorite as a manager was, do me a favor, write all your concerns down on a piece of paper, then light that shit on fire because no one gives a shit what you think. If brains were dynamite, he couldn't blow his nose. Let's see, we'll just get one more here. That boy could hide his own Easter eggs. I got Winston Churchill lunk by an elderly British woman aristocrat, where he replied, yes, madam, I am drunk and you are ugly in the morning. I will no longer be drunk, but you will still be ugly. That's not the one I thought it was. Okay, I'll just tell you the other one I saw that somebody posted from Winston Churchill. There was a woman that told him that if I were your wife, I would poison your tea. And his response was, madam, if you were my wife, I would drink it. Anyway, there's no value in this other than humor. But, man, with the way the world is right now, humor is something we should have some fun with. All right, next up, I got a practical, real-world homestead thing that might help you in the future, even if it's not for geese. So we have had Rachel says, I don't have the patience or the crayons to talk to you, to add one more to the insults. All right, so we have had these three geese, and it's a lopsided trio, meaning two males and one female, for like 4 years. We actually got two pairs, and the female gosling didn't make it. She died. So we ended up with this, and it's very hard to get a single female goose. Really, really hard. No one wants to sell them that way or anything. Don't want to do pairs or sell males. And so there's been always a little tension between the two males, but it's been manageable. Something a couple weeks ago, I don't know what happened, and all of a sudden it was goose warfare. To the point where the lesser goose could not go in the goose duck house at night. He couldn't go in without getting attacked. So I'm starting to think, like, this is bad because if a predator doesn't get him, eventually the weather is going to turn. It's going to get cold. And there's nights where you need those animals inside for their own safety. And I can't put them in there to get beat up, and I can't leave them out. So I got to figure something out. And I was like, what do I do? I'm like, you know what? The one that's an asshole, maybe he just needs to be Thanksgiving goose, because then we would have a pair of geese, and everything would be fine. Yeah. But I really don't want to do that either. He's an old goose. He's not going to be that delicious. He's going to be kind of tough. So can I fix the problem? And then I remembered something. I remembered something from school when I was in, like, second or third grade. I remember one of those SRA reader things, you know, where you read and you answered the questions, you know, that was in a box and you just pulled them out and did it all on your own, Gen X. And I remember reading this story. And the story, and it turned out this was a real story. There was an aquarium, and they had one of the first ever pilot whales in captivity. And they put the pilot whale with dolphins. And the water, you know, is like 6 foot deep. And this giant tank that they all swim around in. And the whale turns into an instant asshole, just like this goose. He's beating the shit out of the dolphins constantly. And they're like, what do we do? And they're like, well, we got to get rid of the whale. And they don't want to get rid of the whale. They want to have a whale so people come see the whale. So they decide what they'll do is they will drain. Somebody gets this idea, like, let's try this before we get rid of the whale. They drain the water down to about 3 foot. The dolphins are like, woo-hoo, they just play in it. They don't care. 3 foot's fine. The whale is not going to die, but he's stuck. He's beached. He is on the bottom, and he can't move. Now, the whale starts crying out in whale sounds, which I'm sure the dolphins don't speak whale, but the sound of distress is universal. Now, the dolphins who had been bullied could have been a dick to the whale, but they don't. They start swimming around the whale, and they start, like, nuzzling him and shit, and they start using soothing dolphin sounds to calm the whale down. They let this go on for about 30 minutes. They put the water back in the tank. The whale swims away, happy, and the dolphins and the whale get along. And I went, I can't replicate that, but I can replicate part of it. So what I did, I went out the other night, and, you know, the lesser goose is there, and I shoved him in. He didn't want to go in. As soon as I did, out comes the neck of the bigger goose to get him. I grabbed him right by his freaking head. I put his ass outside, and I closed the door and locked his ass out instead. And immediately, like, started bawling, left him, went back in the house. We heard him walk up to the house and yell at us. And he was walking back and forth all night yelling. Next night I go out, there's a lot less tension now. But he's still aggressive looking when I put the lesser goose in the coop, because he still doesn't want to go in on his own. I don't know if this is going to go kinetic at night, and now they can't get away from each other, right? Light in the eyes, grab by the head, straight out goes the bigger goose, door gets closed, starts bawling again. That was one night ago. Last night, last two nights I go out, everybody's in the coop together, everything's peaceful. Being on that outside of that door and realizing one way or another, this sucks, somehow rebooted the goose brain, because it's not a very big brain. But, you know, birds are very smart relative to other animals. They're incredibly intelligent. Their problem-solving ability and things like that. So the little bird brain worked something out. Something, I'm not going to say he went, oh, this sucks, so I don't want to do it to him. I don't think that geese have empathy at all. I think they're probably one of the least empathetic creatures on the planet. All right? The goose comes for you, he's going to take your soul if he could. When they bite you and nothing happens, they're like, stupid beak doesn't kill. Why don't I have teeth? And wing beating, they can put a pretty good beating on you. But something rebooted. And I think it was the same dynamic. Something about being yanked out and thrown out and having that door shut and having to be stressed about it made him think, I would rather be in there than out here. And so that became his focus, and that took his focus off the other goose. And when they're walking around now, there's no aggression. They're back to the way they always were. Occasionally there's a hiss, whatever. But I just thought that might be helpful. And I actually think there's a lot of things like that. Like, one of the things I have found that works, if you have a broody chicken and she won't go, I had a guest, I don't remember who it was, but he said he just takes the chicken off the nest and, like, with a stock tank, just full on dunks them like four times in a stock tank and throws them. And then they run off all pissed off. And if they come back to the nest, the next time you see them on the nest, you do it again. Like, this is when you don't want them brooding. And two or three times, they'll stop brooding. I tried it. It works. It doesn't work on a duck. They don't care. All a duck's going to do when you grab them off the nest like that is bite you and shit on you. But with a chicken, it works perfectly. So when you have a problem, try being a little bit creative and thinking about these patterns and seeing. Like, here's another way to look at it. I was talking to Nick Ferguson about something one time. I don't even remember what it was. But I'm like, when something's just not working or you keep getting the result you don't want, I'm like, do something different. He's like, yeah, anything different. Do anything different and get a result and see what happens. So I thought that would be an interesting little thing right there. Stymie says, if I lock my kids outside for a night or two, will they suddenly appreciate what they have? They might. They might. Hey, if you're Gen X, we got locked out of the house, just not at night. We got knocked out of the house like every Saturday and Sunday. Like, as soon as your chores were done, they threw us out. And, like, don't come home until the street light comes on, right? We appreciated our homes. I think we really did. All right. Moving on. I started a newsletter. And of all things, especially for me, I started a newsletter on LinkedIn under jackslaws.com, not under the Survival Podcast. This is about business, marketing, and things like that, because that's what LinkedIn is about. I want to let you know about it, and if you use LinkedIn, please feel free to subscribe. I launched this, I think, on Saturday, and it's already got like 200 subscribers, and I haven't like promoted it on air or anything like that, so that's a pretty good thing. I wanted to talk about why as a bit of a business lesson here. I think one of the reasons that my podcast took off the way that it did in the early days is it hit a need that didn't exist yet. Somebody to talk about things like we talk about in a way that was relatable and a way that you could listen to while you did other things, because podcasting was new. In 2009, 2010, by the time, like, I was making a full-time living at this by the end of 2009. And so when somebody said, what do you do for a living? What is your job? I would say, I'm a podcaster. And the first question I got is, what's a podcast? Well, today, if you say you're a podcaster, like, oh, wow, like, what's your podcast about? You could immediately have a conversation. My Uber driver on the way back from the airport, like, literally subscribed to my podcast during the drive back when he asked me about it. So things have changed now. So it's a lot more competitive. What does that have to do with LinkedIn? LinkedIn has turned into an AI slop hole. All it is just people posting bullshit written by AI. But there's still some really good, solid content and people there if you care about business and networking and AI and stuff like that. But what's lacking is real information, the kind of thing you want to see, you want to read, you can learn something from. So I'm like, I don't have time for a whole new endeavor or whatever, but I can write one article a week. So the first article that I put out on the newsletter is called It's Your Fault, and That's Great. And you can read the article for yourself. It's probably a 5-minute read, and there's a link to the newsletter in the show notes today. But the basic concept of this is that we need to separate fault and responsibility from each other, because they are temporally separated. And in this article, I tell you, this is not just business. This could be getting passed over for a promotion, but it could also be having an argument with your wife or making an excuse for why you can't lose weight because food's too expensive. It doesn't matter. It's all the same. Or the government set you up to fail with their food pyramid or whatever bullshit you come up with. See, the thing is that fault and responsibility have been blended in our world today. And this is how they separate. Fault is in the past by its very nature. If something's wrong, it already happened. Therefore, the cause is in the past. If it's 1 minute ago, 1 month ago, 1 year ago, 10 years ago, it's still in the past. So fault is always in the past. You can contribute to it. You could be 100% responsible for it, or it can be somebody else entirely that caused it. You're minding your own business. Two guys jumped out and clubbed you in the head, and now you have a brain injury. You bear no fault for that happening unless you broke the rule of stupid places with stupid people, and that's why you got hit, right? Still, it shouldn't have happened, right? So fault in the past. Responsibility is from the present to the future. So when you tell somebody they're responsible, what they hear is it's your fault. This is a huge mistake in life. And the thing is, as long as you take the approach of responsibility and fault being the same, you can't change anything. You can't make anything better. You can't do anything about your situation. And there's so many people, I'll never buy a house. It's all the government's fault. It's the Republicans' fault. It's the boomers' fault. I don't give a shit whose fault it is. It's your responsibility. And the minute you take that and you start asking that magic question we teach, how can I, you start finding answers. And so I just want to let you guys know that newsletter is available. Go check it out on LinkedIn, link in the show notes today. Last, I want to talk a little bit about one chapter of Laws of Life Book 2. I'm going to go real quick on it today. But it's Chapter 3 in Laws of Life Book 2, and it's Ideas Are Useless, Execution of Ideas is Priceless. And I added to it for today, Don't Be Idea Guy. So what I want you to understand, and this is part of like why we're building the Find a Business course, your ideas are nothing. Ideas are useless. I'll put it this way. If ideas were worth anything, let's have a really great idea. I have an idea for a car that can travel at the speed of light. It'll avoid all traffic, and it'll just basically get you where you want to go immediately. It has all the sensors, so it won't get destroyed or hit, a speck of dust will kill it. And it just levitates, and it just light speed, and you drop down at your bank or your job or whatever. Okay. And you say, well, that's stupid because we can't build a car like that. Yeah, that's my point. That's why I chose that or something else like it, because the idea itself is patently useless. How about an idea that actually could have worked? It's in my book. I talk about this. I should get negative points for my idea. When I was like 22 years old, my best friend at the time had somebody steal the tailgate off his truck, a Ford Ranger. It cost something like $515 to get a new tailgate, and his deductible was $500. So he didn't even put it on his insurance because He didn't want his insurance to go over, up over a $15 claim. It wasn't worth it. But I immediately kind of locked onto it and said, man, that would be easy to build a lock for that would retrofit on all these trucks. And I'm sitting here in Texas in the 90s going, every other car is a truck, right? Every other vehicle is a truck. Look at all these potential customers. And I came up with like three different ways that you could build a tailgate lock. And one was really simple. It was just basically an expander with kind of like a key like a soda machine has. And you could put it on the inside or outside, and it would just basically pressure the gate so it wouldn't come down. I came up with one to go over top of the thing. I came up with all these ideas for a tailgate lock. It was about 10 years later that almost every truck that rolls off the lot now has an integrated lock because this was a real need. I had that idea. Was it a good idea? Yes. Was it marketable? Yes. What did the idea mean? Nothing. Why? Because I didn't do shit with it. It's actually worse for me that I had that idea when I did because it was viable. It's worse when it's viable. I want you guys to understand clearly that if you have an idea that's worth pursuing, then make a plan and pursue it or drop it so it's not in your brain as intellectual masturbation and you find something productive to actually execute. If you want more stuff like that, check out Laws of Life Book 2, Laws of Life Book 1, both of them are great. They're available on Amazon or on my websites. So check it out. Again, Laws of Life Book 1 and 2. And then I have one more thing for you today. Really didn't have much of an item of the day going on last week for T-Spaz, but I do have one for you today. And the reason I brought it around today is because I posted a picture of mine over the weekend. And the biggest question I got was, where'd you get it? Who makes it? And it's a magnetic knife holder that looks like wood. It looks like acacia wood. It's actually girdled in acacia wood, but it's a really strong magnet. Holds your knife in your kitchen. And what happened is I just had my kitchen remodeled. Actually, I had my dining room and my garage, my dining room and my living room remodeled, and we went and kind of freshened up the kitchen. And when we did that, that meant we had the paint done and the trim repainted and some stuff done. And so all the stuff had to come off the wall. So I had kind of some janky shelves for my spices, for my everyday, you know, constant grab spices. And I had these magnetic strips that I wasn't really in love with. So my wife helped me pick out the shelves, and then she wanted something that matched them. So the acacia would match. And I picked this one up, 24 inches, super strong magnet, super easy to mount. It does have like the hidden mounting in the back, but it's done in the sensible way, not the dumb way. It's got like the where you put your two anchor screws in and you just pull it down and it locks. Very easy to do. I made a little paper template so I knew where to drill the holes and make them level. And I love the damn thing. It really just makes my life a little bit better in my kitchen. So since so many people asked about it, I went ahead and brought it out. And then those little shelves down there, they'll come out later this week. Those are cool too. But there's a link in the write-up today if you want to know about those shelves. Because they're kind of badass for the purpose. But again, this is a knife holder that is made by a company called Modern Innovations. I really like their whole product lineup. And get this. So I figured it would be all kitchen stuff. When I checked out their store, they have shooting targets. So it's not every day you can buy your kitchen gear from a company that also makes shooting targets. So I thought it would be pretty cool. So check them out. And you know, your knives don't belong in a drawer. They get beat up that way. And those blocks, they really don't, they're not good for your knives either. This is kind of the best way to keep your knives accessible and out of the way at the same time so they're not taking up too much space and what have you. And the one thing you really need to make sure of any of these knife holders, that they have a strong enough magnet that that knife doesn't fall and hit somebody in the hand or the foot or something like that. And that was the biggest thing people asked me about when they saw it. Like, how does it hold? It holds really, really great. That said, I wouldn't put a heavy cleaver or like a heavy, thick butcher's knife on any of these things. I just don't trust them. But your day-to-day chef's knives, Santoko's, your boning knives and things like that, fantastic for them. All right, 4 minutes over. That was a lot of content, though, guys. Hope you enjoyed it. Hey. Cooking? You want to hear about cooking? Tune in tomorrow. Tomorrow's episode, the live stream is already set up on YouTube. Cooking with Jack in 2026. We're going to talk about great ways to cook fantastic food and save money at a time when food is more expensive than ever. That's coming tomorrow. I got a great interview for you this week. Remember, Tickets go on sale for the workshop on the 19th. Seats go on sale with the discount on Monday the 14th for you for the new AI course. Take care, guys. You
they said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month.